I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. There are five original film scores that are up for an Oscar this Sunday, and they include Hans Zimmer's and his haunting use of a single note for Dunkirk, Johnny Greenwood's discordant and off-kilter music for piano and violins for Phantom Thread, Alexander Desplat's moody and liquidy theme for The Shape of Water, Carter Burwell's music that has a kind of a cowboy western feel for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and finally John Williams' soaring score for Star Wars The Last Jedi. I should add that this is Williams' 51st nomination. Today on Radio Times, we're going to play selections from these nominated scores and talk about what makes good movie music, what it takes to score a film, and why some of these themes have endured. And we have two guests who have joined us, including Troy Herrien. He's a composer. He writes for film, theater, dance, and the experimental arts. His most recent film score is for the magical realist documentary 306 Hollywood. He also composed the five-movement Pig Iron Theater production of A Period of Animate Existence that I saw here in Philadelphia. Troy Herrien joining us from the NPR studios in New York. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And also joining us by telephone from Chicago is Michael Phillips. He's a film critic for the Chicago Tribune, also part of an ongoing project called The Film Score at WFMT, the classical station in Chicago. And Michael Phillips, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Let me start with you, Michael, and just generally speaking, these five Oscar nominations, are these worthy pieces of music from your perspective?
Well, I think they illustrate the idea that memorable doesn't necessarily mean good. but we can get to my specific objections with a couple of the scores. But
sure.
I love the range. I mean, the range of these five, just in terms of the atmosphere they create and the stories they're accompanying, is really, really remarkable. And in the case of a first-time nominee, Johnny Greenwood, for his score for Phantom Thread, I think that's some of the most luxurious film music I've heard in a decade. So I'm thrilled with that. I don't think he's necessarily going to win, but you know, that's a particularly rich score. But you know, as I say, you get five completely different personalities in these scores.
And I do want to play that and the other four scores. What did you hear in these nominations, Troy?
Well, I agree. They are very different from one another. It's really apples and oranges totally all the way through. It's an interesting thing to figure out how to judge each one because they have totally different goals. They have totally different techniques. But I also agree that Phantom Thread really stuck out to me.
Well, since you both mentioned the Phantom Thread, let's play. This is The Hem. And it's a part of Johnny Greenwood's score for Phantom Thread. Let's give it a listen. Thank you. the Hem, part of Johnny Greenwood's score for Phantom Thread, and it is a film by Paul Thomas Anderson starring Daniel Day-Lewis as an obsessive dress designer and his muse. Troy, let me begin with you. What did you hear in that?
I just love that cue so much. It's one of those things that I hear and I sort of wish that I wrote it. It's interesting because it sounds like a Radiohead song to me. And I mean, so for anyone who doesn't know Johnny Greenwood, most people probably know Johnny right. Greenwood is the guitar player of Radiohead and one of the songwriters. And it sounds almost like one of their songs, but for acoustic instruments. I hear the classical composer influences that he talks about. He says that Bach and Messiaen are two composers that show up in almost all of his music. You absolutely hear it, but this is his voice. It's synthesized into somebody who I think is original. And then as far as, you know, film composing goes, it's not just an interesting composition on its own. It is absolutely a great film cue in that it's simple, it's efficient, it's packed with emotion and color, and it's inspired, which is not always easy to do when you have to write cues quickly.
Well, and Michael, not to give too much of the film away for people who haven't seen it, but I think it sort of matches the tension and the almost horror that one feels in watching this film.
Yeah, it's a completely idiosyncratic and macabre love story.
to say the least, yes.
You know, It's not music you know you wouldn't mistake it for Star Wars, and it's got, but what I love about what Greenwood's accomplished with Phantom Thread is, if you listen to other selections from that score he wrote, particularly House of Woodcock, which is the main character Reynolds Woodcock is the dress designer played by Day-Lewis. House of Woodcock is the lushest, most approachable, most kind of luxurious film theme I have heard in a decade, as I said, and it's a complete. That sounds very different from what we just heard, but the miracle really is that this film, which has a very strange variety of personalities and moods, has a score that reflects that, and the score somehow makes sense in and among existing musical selections that are used in the picture, ranging from Debussy to Nelson Riddle and Oscar Peterson. And somehow that music that he wrote ties it all together. It's amazing.
Well, and Troy, just to add to that, he did work with Paul Thomas Anderson on There Will Be Blood and The Master. So clearly these two have a productive and fruitful working relationship.
Yeah, it's been developing, and I follow, you know, interviews that Johnny Greenwood gives because I'm very curious about his career. And I don't know, There Will Be Blood was also a really interesting film score, but it wasn't eligible for an Oscar because most of it was written as concert music. It wasn't specifically written for the film. So the fact that this music was written for the film, it fits the film. Although it's one thing that's interesting is that the synchronization of the music to the picture is unusual. It's not super tight. It's not following every motion and every twist of a character's development. It's kind of a loose synchronization, which I think also is a style. It's an unusual style. It's not something you see very often. And I think it contributes to sort of the poetic reverie of the film as a whole.
Well, let's play another piece of music. This is the main theme from the film, The Shape of Water, composed by Alexandre Desplat. And this is for the film by Guillermo del Toro, a different kind of love story, I should say, compared to Phantom Thread. Let's give it a listen.
Thank you.
And again, the theme from The Shape of Water. Michael, what did you think of that?
I like it. I like this plot. You know, he's got a fairly light touch, as well as a really interesting broad palette. And he won his first Oscar, I believe, a couple of years ago for The Grand Budapest Hotel, which is a score I really adored. And he's also written, you know, very interesting, really jaunty, infectious stuff for Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Oh, goodness, yes.
You know.
The best.
I know that he's... What's that?
The best.
Yeah, I know that. And I know that he spoke of wanting to create somehow for The Shape of Water the sound of what it feels like to be in water, and because there's a lot of that going on in this picture. And I think he actually found a way to do it without a lot of cliche sort of crescendos and musical waves, if you know what I mean. And, you know, he's night and day for me from someone like Hans Zimmer, who we'll get to, I know, in a minute, whose attack really is kind of a full frontal 10-ton assault on whatever the story's up to. And all these composers are trying to create a kind of tension and a conversation with what's going on in the story. And I think Desplat has a nice way of letting Del Toro, who's a very formidable stylist, and there's, you know, that's a film of very strong extremes and, you know, a lot of violence and sex and a lot of action and, you know, a lot, that's about 17 movies in one. And the score kind of lets it happen, lets it breathe. And I think he's, you know, he works constantly like a lot of these guys do, but he's good. I'd like to hear what Troy thinks.
Yeah, me too, Troy. Very briefly, if you don't mind, and we're almost up in a break here.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about this score. I think that it's a sweet. The theme is a sweet European waltz. Up until right where the example cut off, accordion jumps in, and that's the part that I just don't buy with this score. I don't understand. It starts to sound very Parisian, and I'm not really sure where that's coming from. But it's good. It's a solid score. The instrumentation's good. The underwater theme, I think there's a glass harmonica in there, which is an unusual thing to hear. So, you know, I like that theme. I think that it's solid.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we're going to hear Bernard Herrmann's score for the film North by Northwest. And I do want to talk about Bernard Herrmann as a composer for movies, and that's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. Troy Herriam, Michael Phillips, our guest. We are playing selections of the nominated films or scores for this Sunday's Oscars. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Much more music and conversation after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and today in this show on Radio Times, we're talking about this year's nominees for Best Original Score. The Academy Awards is this Sunday. Talking with Troy Herriam. He's a composer who writes for film, theater, dance, and the experimental arts. Also with us, Michael Phillips, and he is a film critic for the Chicago Tribune. Also part of this ongoing project called The Film Score at WFMT, the classical music station in Chicago. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Troy, if you could just comment about Bernard Herrmann and what he was able to do for Alfred Hitchcock. I know that could be a whole hour there, but is there a short answer to that?
Huge...
It is.
You know,
I agree.
I think one of the things that he did was he brought serious contemporary composition to film. And the composers before him were absolutely serious, and they had, you know, Korngold, Steiner, they did these big European lush orchestrations that John Williams later sort of referred to. But Bernard Herrmann was somebody who brought cutting-edge technique, contemporary technique, really thoughtful, artistic, grappling with concepts. And he, I mean, wrote timeless themes.
Yeah. Anything you want to add to that, Michael?
My God, I love Herrmann. I mean, you know, it's some of the collaboration between Bernard Herrmann and Alfred Hitchcock is just one of the key artistic partnerships the cinema ever produced. And And again, the variety is astonishing, even though Herman has a certain drive, and I like that word, furious. But the Psycho score, which is entirely strings, is entirely different from what he wrote for Vertigo or what we just heard a little bit of North by Northwest. And what I hope in a very different style is that today you got Johnny Greenwood and Paul Thomas Anderson slowly building a collaboration that may one day equal that contribution. And I'd love to hear some more Herman right now.
Well, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to hear some Hans Zimmer because we've got that queued up.
Man, what a come down.
I'm sorry about that, but it's next. It's next in the queue here. But let me just set it up for our listeners. This is The Pulse, part of Hans Zimmer's score for the film Dunkirk, a film by Christopher Nolan, and it is about the evacuation of Allied troops off the beaches of Dunkirk during World War II. Let's give it a listen, and then we'll hear what our guests have to say. Clock ticking in there. So, Troy, what's your take on this theme?
Well, when you hear it out of context, it's meaning without the film, you notice that, okay, how is this music? It doesn't necessarily have a melody that I can hear or a harmony, not even really a rhythm. I hear a pulse, but that's it. But when you see it with the film, when you hear it with the film, you notice things like, wow, was that the airplane engine that just sort of turned into strings? Was that the boat engine that sort of turned into something musical? And what Hans Zimmer was doing was really blurring the lines between sound design and music. And so in that particular cue, I hear the sound design turning into music, and then, of course, a tremendous amount of psychological tension that's building there, which I think was really one of his biggest goals, to make almost a transparent soundtrack that also made you feel really tense.
Let me read.
Something's building.
Indeed. Here's an email from Bernice. When we saw Dunkirk in the theater, I remarked to my husband, I wonder what this would be like without all this loud music. I found it really intrusive. I was actually very taken with it, and I thought when I listened to it, I thought, oh, this must be Trent Reznor. It just didn't feel like Hans Zimmer. What didn't you like about it, Michael?
Well, I think the film is unrelievedly intense by design, and I admire a great deal of Dunkirk, although I have some issues with it. But I find that when you layer on top of the film itself a musical score that is also monomaniacally intense, and again by design does not allow the audience any catharsis or resolution of a theme until maybe the very end, I find it suffocating, maybe in less than helpful ways. Zimmer's mm-hmm. more of a Well, he's a full frontal assault composer. I think, frankly, he's picked up some less than terrific habits about what'll work for movies like the Pirates of the Caribbean pictures or
very different from this one.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes. But I also think that he's never. I don't know if he's ever really learned subtlety or really has any interest in it.
Well, it's interesting because I was reading some conversations between him, Hans Zimmer, and Christopher Nolan, the director, and they said in many ways they wanted this movie, and I'll toss this to you, Troy, to be about time. And you do hear a clock ticking, and of course, will these troops be evacuated before they're all going to be killed? I mean, this is a piece of history, but nonetheless, it is in many ways about time.
Yes, and there were some very strict concepts that Hans Zimmer and Christopher Nolan stuck to as far as how time sounded in the film. So there was this there's this thing called a shepherd tone.
Yeah, what is that? I saw that.
Yeah, right. So usually it means it's a pitch that sounds like it's continuously rising. It's sweeping up and up and up, and it's constructed using a few different notes that are maybe an octave apart or something. But it's an aural illusion that sounds like it's sweeping up for infinity. It never stops, but actually it does. It's an illusion. So what they do through time is that they make something sound like it's speeding up forever. And they use a similar technique of some one sound that speeds up while another one takes over from below, and it starts from the slow beat and then it gradually accelerates again. So the clock ticking you hear throughout the score, sometimes it is a second and sometimes it is four times as fast as a second, but it's still that clock ticking sound. You think back, when did it speed up? I can't quite point to that moment because it's very continuous and it's very sly.
And works, obviously, on the unconscious. Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I was going to say, and that is a very clever way of also, complementing the three different time signatures of the storytelling in Dunkirk, because you have three central plot lines, each taking place across a different span of time. An hour, a day, a week, I believe. And that's a certain amount of complexity right there. So then you have Zimmer adding a different sort of it with these shepherd tones. One, the bass notes come in and then rise just as an octave up, something else is happening. And your description, Troy, was slightly more technically astute than mine of a shepherd tone, I think.
Well, that's why he's here, and you're here, Michael. That's great. Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. We're talking about the art of scoring films, what makes a good film score, some of the best composers who have taken up the form, and playing selections from this year's nominees for Best Original Score. And again, Troy Herrien joining us from the NPR Studios in New York City. He's a composer, and he writes for film, theater, dance, and the experimental arts. Michael Phillips is film critic for the Chicago Tribune, part of this project called The Film Score at WFMT, the classical station in Chicago. And again, you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Let me read a couple of more comments here. One from Janet. She says, I agree that the music is such a big part of the whole film experience. I like his music overall. Dunkirk is a great movie. Don't think I'd buy the soundtrack alone. Which is an interesting thing, Troy, about whether for a film score, do you need to watch the movie to feel like you're experiencing the film? Or there are film scores that are standalone because they're designed that way, I guess.
Both exist, and you might have a great theme that isn't necessarily a great film score. A lot of film composers are working under a single goal, and that is to serve the story. So there are times where a composer might say, hey, I could write something that is really complex musically and has this beautiful melody, but you throw it up against the picture and it draws attention away from a character or a certain plot line, and you have to be simpler.
Yeah.
So, it's a coincidence sometimes when you have both. It's music that you'd like to listen to on its own for all of its own merits, and it also works in the film. And, the other thing that happens is that composers change their music to release a soundtrack. They might have had something that they edited out. Maybe it was a instrumental line that was a flute that was a little too loud, but it was a beautiful melody, but it was too loud. It was competing with the dialogue. Then they release the soundtrack and they put the flute back in because they say, that was necessary for the music to really tie together.
Well, let's play another selection from one of the nominees this Sunday, and this is Billboards on Fire, part of Carter Burwell's score for the film Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And the director for this film is Martin McDonough. And again, it's about a woman who is enraged about the rape and murder of her daughter and the fact that she hasn't gotten the justice that she is looking for, that she wants. Let's give this a listen. So, Michael, what do you hear in that? I hear a Western.
And the film really does have a lot of Western mythology in it, I think. Frances McDormand has spoken of really basing her character on John Wayne. I mean, that's you know, we hear certainly the mandolin is taking, you know, kind of the lead in terms of the putting us in a certain place and maybe time, you know, the footstops and hand clamps all give it that kind of, you know, Western sort of search for justice, I think, that the film trades in. It's a good score. I think Burwell's written wonderful things for the Coen brothers and Charlie Kaufman movies in particular. So I'd say if you really want a different personality of his, you can listen to something like the Coens' A Serious Man or the Charlie Kaufman film Anomalisa, which is a lovely score. And, you know, Burwell's a really interesting, versatile talent. And, yeah, it's a worthy nomination. I don't love the film, but I like the music.
Do you like the music, Troy?
I like half of the music. I mean, I really like what you played. I like what you played. I you know, it's the same. I hear the same things. I hear the Morricone references, the you know, the classic spaghetti Western scores, things that stick out to my ear. I love the tubular bells that they use and the timpanis. It's so, like, why would you pair a timpani with acoustic guitar? It happens in these Western scores, and it's just so, it's a great sound. It's an unusual sound. The one thing that I noticed, though, is, you know, if you listen to the Morricone scores, there's so much reverb. And you think, what is that there for when you hear these echoes of the instruments? And it's probably because there's so much landscape that you see, you know, the desert behind you, and it's this expansive thing. And this, what we just heard, is very dry. And it's almost using the same tropes, but it's very tight and closed and almost claustrophobic. And I think that that was one of the senses I did get from this film. There's not a lot of landscape. It's very close in. So, you know, maybe that was another choice that I think is a crafty choice. The part that I didn't like so much is the second theme, maybe I would say, is the grief theme, which just sounds, I think, it's a little too safe and a little too ordinary for me. Yeah.
Troy, we're going to play a portion of your score for a documentary called The Dog. It's about the man who was the inspiration, actually, for Al Pacino's character in Dog Day Afternoon. We're going to sort of sneak it up under you while you talk a bit about this, and we're almost up in a break here. But what were you thinking in terms of scoring for this documentary?
There was a lot of research into music from the time period of the 70s or New York. There was underground music, and there was also the cinematic music of the time. So strings mixed with percussion and Fender Rhodes piano, some production techniques like echo and all that kind of stuff. And I seem to remember this particular cue. I had a writing partner. His name's Mark Danzinger. He's a good friend of mine. And we said, we want to make it sound like you're cooking chocolate chip cookies, just really... really seductive and smooth, and that's what we were going for.
That is a perfect setup to this score that is written by our guest, Troy Herrien, for a documentary. He was involved in the inspiration for Al Pacino's character in Dog Day Afternoon, and the documentary is called The Dog. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with Troy Herrien and Michael Phillips talking about scoring music for movies. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about movie music, original scores. The Academy Awards are this Sunday, and there are five scores that are up for an Oscar. And we're playing selections from each of them. And talking with Troy Herrien, who's a composer. He writes for film, theater, dance, and the experimental arts. And Michael Phillips, who's a film critic for the Chicago Tribune. Let me get Chris, who's been waiting very patiently from Philadelphia. Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Mari. I thought your guests might be interested in this. They touched on a bit of a dichotomy of relationship between composer and director when you're speaking about people like Sergio Leone or Kurosawa, for example, and people that worked for them very consistently. And they spoke about, you know, Johnny Greenwood and Paul Thomas Anderson. What I'm curious about is being a bit of a composer and have touched in some film score work and live in the Philadelphia area. The landscape is so much changed from film work to, let's say, the Gonzalez working with the Nick and certain people that are in more the network cable kind of world. There's a lot of creativity and a bit of a renaissance of sorts going on there, and I was curious with what their take was on how things have shifted and what composers are to do, perhaps, in considering this shift in so far as you almost have to live in L.A. to be a part of that world, so to speak.
Well, Chris, let me see what Troy has to say about that. Troy, any thoughts?
Well, as far as geographic location, yeah, of course, the traditional film industry is in L.A., but I live in New York and I work as a composer. I think that it's always moving around. There are great composers who live everywhere and they make, but the most important thing really seems to be the relationship with the filmmaker, from the composer's perspective at least, is to have a close relationship with the filmmaker and have them believe in your music, something that goes, you know, two ways.
Well, let me play the final selection for an Oscar this Sunday, and this is the main theme from The Last Jedi, composed by none other than John Williams.
Thank you.
So, Michael Phillips, what do you think?
Well, you know, it's John Williams' eighth Star Wars musical score. What is it like to be John Williams and to take on a new Star Wars film and say, how the hell am I going to make it sound not desperately derivative of the last seven? And, you know, he actually manages to solve that problem like a really reliable old pro. You know, he there's a lot of weaving in and out of themes we've heard from, you know, since 1977. And yet, just by subtle reorchestration, or really not so subtle reorchestration, but, you know, a new spin or a new twist on an old theme over and over, it develops into kind of a new, a good, familiar but not hackneyed, best of John Williams sound. You know, is it really my kind of film music? But I think there's a little bit of a The one downside of the influence of the original Star Wars score, I think, is that he really laid it on like wallpaper. I mean, that music covers, you know, the majority of the running time, and it's so different from, say, Jerry Goldsmith, a great composer I've always loved, and his approach to something like everything from Patton to Chinatown back in the 70s. He wrote only 20 or 30 minutes of music for movies that even Patton ran 3 hours. It only had 37 minutes of music. And you know what? You really noticed it.
Oh, that's interesting. And we should add that I believe this is his 51st nomination for Best Score. Troy, let me read a couple of comments here. Tweet says, you got to love John Williams. A tweet from Tim says, one of the things that makes John Williams' music work, I think, is his use of leitmotifs, colorful characters, even a shark, are given memorable motifs. With Star Wars, he's now able to tell the story and imply subtleties through music alone. What do you hear, Troy?
Well, of course, you hear the themes. It's almost like when you listen to a Star Wars movie, it's like collecting themes. It's like collecting baseball cards or something. How many can you name, and you tick them off? And the other thing that I hear is the world-class craftsmanship of orchestral writing. Yeah. It's just, there's nobody who compares with the orchestration. And the sad thing is we just take it for granted with John Williams because it's, I mean, from the classical history, it's almost like Haydn wrote over 100 symphonies, and it's like, well, here's another one. John Williams sort of does the same thing, and here's another Star Wars. If it was the first time he wrote Star Wars, I think people would be freaking out, but it is the eighth time. So, you know, it's something that we're used to. I often say sometimes when if I go see the Metropolitan Opera and you're there, it's a world-class opera, world-class orchestra, and you see the audience, everybody, their jaw drops for the first 15 minutes, and then you kind of get used to it. And I think that's sort of what happens with John Williams. And it's if you even under the blasts, the sound effects of the lightsabers and the explosions, even that music that you can't hear is incredible and incredibly complex and lush. So it's just somebody who's full of craft and discipline. And, yeah, he's one of a kind, but we're kind of used to it, I think.
Let me read an email from Bruce from West Philly. Mike, I'm going to toss this to you. He says, I can't believe Hans Zimmer didn't get nominated for the Blade Runner score. It's great music, and the movie relies heavily on the score to set the mood, and also to understand some of the understated scenes. Can you conjure up that music?
Yeah, it's also the music, I think, in the new Blade Runner film, you know, has an obligation, or it felt an obligation, to tie the sound into what we heard back in 1982 with the original Blade Runner, and I believe it's Vangelis, was that right, Troy, who wrote the score to that?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and that's a very, you know, it's a synth-heavy sound, and, you know, it sounds now kind of both futuristic and retro. But that Hans Zimmer kind of has to, I think, honor some of that by going his own way. I like that score. I prefer it in some ways, although it is in its way fiendishly inventive. I prefer it to the Dunkirk score myself. You know, my favorite quote, honestly, about film scoring, Michael Giacchino, who's one of my absolute favorites working right now. He did Ratatouille and Up and The Incredibles. He said, you know, my father was a tailor. I make suits for movies. Oh, and this is the thing about this whole art and craft, right? There's a million different styles you can do within that concept, because not this suit won't work on that body, and it's really up to the composer to pay attention to the shape and the sound of what the director seems to have called for, but also go their own way and say, like Bernard Herrmann did, you know, I know this doesn't make any logical sense, but I want to do a fandango, a Spanish fandango theme for North by Northwest. Where is it set? It's set in Manhattan, you know, and all we're looking at when we hear that music that you played earlier, Marty, was, you know, the outside of a Manhattan skyscraper, you know, with the credits rolling. But there's something about that fandango that makes, in retrospect, perfect sense.
Troy, do you feel like you make suits for directors as a composer yourself?
Yeah, I think it goes both ways. Sometimes you're being led, and sometimes you take the lead. And it's always difficult to say when to do which. And ideally, you have a situation where you can try both. I just heard an interview with Danny Elfman, and he said that he's kind of gotten it down to a science of saying, look, I'm going to do what you asked for, and I'm going to do something that's totally out of left field. And we're just going to see. And, you know, a portion of the time, the things that are totally out of left field become what they use. And he brought up Beetlejuice as an example, and which is one of my favorite scores as growing up. And it's just, you know, they wanted something really kind of safe and ordinary. And he just, you know, made something really rhythmic and jaunty. And it was something that they didn't ask for, but the composer took the lead there. And then, you know, no matter what you do, though, I think that the music is always has to follow the contour of the film. And sometimes you can invent a new contour. You can bring out a shape that nobody really noticed that is attractive. So that happens. But, yes, there is a tailor fit, ultimately, that you end up with.
Well, and as you were talking, Troy, I scribbled Phantom Thread because I read a review somewhere where they felt that was Paul Thomas Anderson talking about what it is to make a movie, which is like making a dress. I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but just I think that's a very interesting way to think about both that movie, but also what it means to score for a movie. Let me read some more comments here. One from Robert. Franz Waxman's score for Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window was good, too, fit the mood of the film. Do you agree, Michael?
Yeah, it's good. I don't think it's like a major score. I love that film, but you know, if you really want to hear Franz Waxman's stuff, you listen to the score for Sorry, Wrong Number, the Barbara Stanwyck thriller from a few years earlier, and that's really, really ripe. And you know, of that era, the guy I love is your Philadelphia's own David Raxon, who scored Laura and The Bad and the Beautiful. And The Bad and the Beautiful is a theme that is not well known, but nobody could figure out the melody when they first played it for the director and the producer. They thought, I don't get it. I don't hear the melody. Then they orchestrated it, and then they heard it a couple times, and suddenly everybody was completely seduced by this grand romantic Hollywood melody. And Raxon always said, my music should not be listened to the first time.
I don't know how to do that.
it takes two rounds to get some of my stuff. So, you know, I don't know if Troy's had that experience or not, but that's a lovely
story.
I just adore it.
Well, yeah, I when I work with directors, I say the music you hear first is the hated music. It's just what it is. And so listen to something a few times. I try to, as best as I can, when I take my criticism, if the director heard something right off the bat, I'm like, oh, I'm going to really wait till tomorrow to hear whether they liked it or not. Yeah, and the other thing that we didn't really talk about, but that does happen, it's a big part of modern film scores, is temp music. And that's something that directors use ahead of time to get their edit. Before they even hire a composer, they have temporary music that they put in, and they hear it hundreds of times before they ever try to have an original score. So the opposite of the first music is the hated music. The music that you hear over and over and over is the beloved music.
Let me read some more comments. Interesting. Let me read some more comments. One from Fernando. A movie score can really draw an audience into a film. I believe Laura's theme did this for Dr. Zhivago. An email for Ellis. Hearing the first minute of the Phantom Thread soundtrack reminded me of the soundtrack to the movie The Deadly Affair, composed by Quincy Jones. Also, the soundtrack to the movie Round Midnight, also enjoyable. I have seen this movie. He hadn't apparently seen The Deadly Affair. Do you have a favorite composer, Michael?
Oh man! Oh, I already mentioned him, but I mean, I love David Raxon so much for those themes, Laura, and The Bad and the Beautiful. I love Nino Rota's music for all kinds of films, but especially for the Fellini pictures. I actually think of the two, Nino Rota's the greater artist. I think everything Fellini was up to, and sometimes in a kind of a indulgent way, Rota always brought out the poetry and the charm in it. I just, you know, you hear the theme from Amarcord or Eight and a Half or La Dolce Vita. I don't know. It's wonderful because it works. That's the perfect example of works as a standalone and absolutely wedded to the images of the movie.
And Troy, we're almost out of time here. Favorite composer for you?
Well, a composer I'm really interested who's writing now is Mika Levy, and she writes experimental scores, I would say. It's more in the avant-garde tradition, and anybody who likes that stuff should check out Under the Skin. Really haunting, creative, bold soundtrack.
Well, that's my favorite music coming up, the final theme from the film Cinema Paradiso, Ennio Morricone playing that, and it makes me weep every time I hear it. Troy Harian, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And he's a composer. He writes for film, theater, dance, and experimental arts. Michael Phillips, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thanks, Marty. Appreciate it.
We loved having you on, film critic for the Chicago Tribune, and again, part of this project called The Film Score at WFMT, the classical station in Chicago. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoen. I got to get a hanky.